Hello and welcome to the Gestalten podcast. My name is Martin Groschwald, and we are talking in this episode about car design in Asia to the head of design for Hyundai, who is no other than Simon Losby. Now, a lot of you have met or have come across Simon in the past. He's a very outgoing guy, has a very strong opinion about things as well. And I am very, very excited to share this conversation with you because he has not just given us a very fantastic input on car design in Korea, but also car design on a global perspective to see how Korea has influenced that and also how the world has influenced Korea in that context. So he will be giving us the outside-in perspective as a foreigner working in Korea in a leadership position and how he sees the environment and how he interprets it moving onwards. So without further ado, here's Simon, here's me, and here's our next episode in Car Design in Asia. Simon, thank you very much for joining the Gestalten podcast. An absolute pleasure.
How cool is that?
And I don't know if you, I don't think you have on, you haven't on too many podcasts as far as I know. You do a lot of PR and stuff like that for Hyundai, but podcasts is something you haven't done too many, have you?
No, I've done a couple, which were fun, but honestly, it's just a case of trying to get into my diary and you got lucky.
Well, it happens that we both know each other for a little bit already.
Yeah,
I think,
exactly.
You know, I have my ways around things a little bit, and we've done a few obviously with people from the Hyundai group overall, but really do appreciate it. And of course, this is on car design and their evolution in Asia. I don't want to say anything false. You have first moved to Asia, at least from what I see on your LinkedIn, in February 2008.
Exactly. My LinkedIn is pretty accurate.
Before we talk about China, Korea, obviously those kind of topics, you were in Wolfsburg before. So of course, everybody kind of understands if you go, you know, to Wolfsburg and you want to go into the whole wide world, there's a lot of stuff out there. But when Volkswagen approached you and said like, hey, Simon, do you want to go to China? What were your first kind of reactions to that? How, you know, did you make that kind of call and say like, I go over to China, because you went pretty much in the high days when everything kicked off over there and the market almost started to explode in that time frame.
You have to wind the clock back 3 years from then. And Murat Gunak was then the head of design of Volkswagen, and he was out in China and had obviously had some meetings with the Shanghai Volkswagen board of directors, and they said they wanted to do more. How can you help us do more? And Murat came back and called me to a meeting and literally said, Simon, I've got a problem, China. And I said, what about China? He said, what are we going to do in the future? And I said, well, how long have I got? And he said, well, how long do you need? And I said, give me 4 weeks and I'll come back with how I would try to answer the question. And so 4 weeks later, I went back and said, this is what I would do. I would try and get a team together of lots of people. I love teams because group intelligence, swarm intelligence. So I put together a sort of plan and said, this is the sort of thing I'd have to do. And he said, all right, how long do you need? I said, well, roughly 4 months for this sort of project. And he said, if you can persuade the board of directors of Shanghai Volkswagen, persuade Volkswagen Group China, Winfried Fahlen and other people, then we'll do it. You can travel wherever you want, with whoever you want, do whatever you want to do, but just give me a good presentation in 6 months. And that was my first experience of, I'd been out to China before privately. That was my first working experience where I met 11 fantastic people who were our team, who we were sort of roughly 4 from engineering, 4 from design, 4 from marketing. And we did a project. And we came back and we gave a recommendation to say, this is what we think we should do. But the main point was the people who were there, the people in that team, and what I saw happening in Shanghai was that, wow, and China, because we traveled around quite a lot, to try and understand what's going on, see the signals. The signals were all over the place. This is about to explode. And it's all coming. And basically, it doesn't matter what we recommend, because whatever we recommend, it's going to happen, because everything's going to happen in China. So we wrapped up that project, made a lot of big recommendations of what we thought would be useful areas and for Volkswagen to dig deep into. And 3 years later, Walter de Silva was in charge by then and the head of, what was it, design project management, effectively, the finances, called me and says, look, we've got a position, Shanghai. No, actually China. We need somebody to head design in China for Volkswagen Group China Beijing, but plus FAW VW in north in Shenzhen and Shanghai Volkswagen in the south. Would you be interested? And on the outside, I was like, you know, I'm renovating a house. The roof's not on at the moment, have no windows. The floors are out. Got kids in school here. Not great timing. Inside, I'm screaming, fantastic. Yes. I mean, lucky because Ellen, my wife, speaks fluent Chinese, writes Chinese. She's an interpreter by trade. And so it was just, I got home that night and I hadn't told my family at all about anything about the conversation. And I said to her, so you're not going to believe what happened to me today. And she looked at me and I kid you not, she looked at me and said, China. I said, whoa, hold on. What on earth? How the heck do you know that? I hadn't told her anything. And so for us as a family, it turned into a very easy decision. I'd already seen what was changing, what was building up, how China was developing, how growth was going, how the companies were having a go, trying to do their own thing. I'd been out in tier 4, 5 cities, seen that there was this desire to do stuff. And yeah, easiest decision to get over there and be part of the momentum.
You said something really interesting, this kind of push. Now, if we look a little bit of where you are right now, I think it was in 2006 when Peter Schreier joined the Kia Hyundai group and started this kind of, you know, built up of what design can be. And, you know, we're obviously looking into that of Korean design now being really at the forefront of Asian design at this moment in time in terms of creativity, new ideas, new, you know, the courage that comes out of it as well.
Yeah.
Now, you being in China, what kind of parallels do you see to that? Or like, you know, was it a little bit like the Wild West and you a lot of things? How was design represented back then in China compared to where it is right now? And maybe not just the respect, but also just the pure skill and how quickly it has developed.
Well, I think what's very interesting, there are some big parallels between China and Korea. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the 50s, 1953, Korean War was just finishing. Officially still at war, but the country was laid bare. The country was flat. China, in a way, similar. There was the Great Leap Forward, Mao Zedong, and both countries have come from zero to where they are today. Now, China, of course, on a scale much, much bigger than South Korea, but South Korea has some of the biggest global brands. Just look at Samsung, look at LG, look at Lotte, look at Hyundai Motor Group. And this has come through from a different background as to why they're so successful. But in China, what was interesting was even back then, it was hard to see the, let's say, understanding from the West about what's going on. Yes, they can earn money, but it was very clear back then that you would only be part of a joint venture whilst they're still making money or we're making life easier for them until it can be done by themselves. And watching China develop was very clear. And I don't know how many presentations I gave about the self-confidence growing in China. There's phases where if you go back to 1978, when Deng Xiaoping said, you know, I'm going to open up China and we're going to build a city here that rivals Hong Kong. And he was on a beach in Shenzhen and there was nothing there. Then fast forward, not very far to the 90s, where something changed all of a sudden, because communist China was cut off from the world, but the internet arrived. It changed everything globally. My friends in the Swan Lake Project, it was as called back then, Ginny Quinn, Elsa Zhang, Chen Shishong, you know who you are if you're listening, amazing people. And we discussed our personal backgrounds in this project and realized we all surfed the internet on the same day for the first time. This is crucial in the change that it enabled, the communication, the seeing what's going on around the world. Because until then, the country was cut off, effectively. So internet happens. Soon after that, China realizes we have to be part of the World Trade Organization to be respected, to a certain degree at least. And of course, they get the Beijing Olympics and they get Expo in 2010 in Shanghai. So there's a globalization of China where China's really becoming a big player. And people in China, basically, at that stage, was soaking up anything from the West. It must be good. It's from overseas. Anything, yeah. with or without taste, it doesn't matter. Just give me something from overseas. But there was a very clear development of self-confidence where the Chinese were clearly saying, and of course you would, what about our story in all this globalization? Actually, they did MAGA before Donald Trump. You know, it was that they're make China great again. And that's the whole drive. They've been doing it for ever since the five-year plan. And the five-year plan, which is the Communist Party plan for the country, is basically a business model for a successful country. But it never goes backwards. It always goes in one direction. You may not agree with it. You're not allowed to disagree anyway. But it goes in one direction. Hence, all these signals that come together now. When you look at the five-year plans, you can look at EV credits. You can look at the support for electric mobility, the support for financial technologies and fintech. And when did WeChat start? 2011. I remember getting WeChat and WeChat Pay, digital currency, taking out cash. It's you know, in Europe, people still tell me, oh, I wouldn't do that on my phone. I would. With some naive belief that they're private. If they don't, everybody knows everything anyway. And the governments can get it if they want, but they're not really interested in you if you're not building bombs or not selling drugs. They're not interested in you. But we have this weird sense that our privacy is guaranteed if we just use our phone and don't access those things. So in China, you just don't allow privacy, and they all know it. So it's like, okay, well, government knows everything anyway. Just don't rock the boat. And so...
So jumping into that quickly, for you as a designer... Yeah, because I think this is a very important factor over here. We always talk when it comes to design about culture, and understanding culture. And I had a conversation with Wonkyu, and we were talking about, you know, what's the Korean culture that's being brought out in the world with the vehicles and everything. And he said to me, it's usually about convenience in that sense. And it seems what you have this, you know, what you're describing just now, also as a designer, is not only do you have to, you know, create these products for the Chinese market, and let's say also with this, you know, with a Korean background, of course, now. But you also have to explain, in particularly for China, the bosses in that point for you that back then in Germany, you know, why these decisions are being made, because we're so far away. If I remember 2015 or something like that, you know, paying by card was still, you know, a rarity mostly in Germany. You have to do most of the stuff in cash, whereas in China, you do pay and all these kind of topics. So the cultural difference is so massive at that point. How could you actually, or how do you believe you could make good products if your bosses, where most of the decisions are being made, are not necessarily understanding how the market went?
Yeah, you, to a greater extent, you have to assume that you are a fly in the ointment, because actually the big global companies just want to do one thing because that's easiest. You know, it's like, oh, and Simon's turned up again and he's asking for something different. But we have our modules in Wolfsburg, and they're the best modules in the world. Why would anybody want something different? Because you realize they don't have the experience of it. A lot of my time was spent then in those days trying to help people understand that just because somebody thinks different doesn't make them wrong. It's just a different way of doing things. And actually, our job was to try and help then the company make products which are more attractive for the domestic market. Volkswagen back then was doing some really positive stuff, some really good stuff. A lot of stuff where I thought, no, I would never do it like that. But that's life. You know, you can't have it all your own way. And there are powers that be who have other information to make their decisions on. But what is fascinating when I now come here to Hyundai Kia is the openness to do things different, to self-challenge, to self-disrupt, to look on a global scale and get the teams around the world, all of whom being part of the main story. Not you're a satellite and, you know, we know best and you don't know shit. But here, especially in our organization, design organization, I guess part of it's like this because of the people that we are, is a case of using all the skills in the group. Because yes, we are successful as a Korean company. We're not desperately trying to look Korean. We're just trying to have the best storytelling behind what we're doing. Let's go back to the end of the Korean War and look at when the main sort of six families started rebuilding Korea together, of whom ours was one, luckily. And our current chairman's great-grandfather wanted to build cars. But he said, but we don't have roads. I'm going to have to build roads first. So he started building roads. And what they had, though, in Korea, which is part of why the culture is as it is and the hierarchy as it is, South Korea has no natural resources. The only natural resource South Korea has is brain power. So no wonder there's such a focus on academic success and a pressure on studying and so on. And that's very different to China. China has a lot of materials their own. Korea's done it in an incredibly successful way. A small country, there's only 50 million people here, with some of the biggest global companies that everybody knows based here. That's, I guess, a real testament to that drive to find a way and to be fast. And it's come from a ground zero in mid-50s, like China did, and developed. And you've been to Seoul. You see how amazing it is and how fast. As Wong Q said from our friends down the road from Kia, the convenience culture, the speed, the efficiency. I mean, you get on a train to go down to Busan, it is on the second it's departing. And if it's a few seconds late, they're apologizing. In UK, you get a train a few seconds late. Sorry, it's not. It's yesterday's train. And so the brain power is important. I think we're very fortunate in Korea that we're a small country that's not had a big war with anybody. You know, say, go to Europe, there have been certain people who have big war, we have big wars, First, Second World War, and everything, American that way. But Korea is kind of this very fortunate, it's this very acceptable alternative.
You said something really interesting just there, the 50 million people, yeah, which means small country, but if you want to be part of the global economy, it's this kind of, you have to adapt to where you want to be. Now, let's be very straightforward here. When Peter Schreier came in, that was a design revolution for what Kias were. And, you know, then successively with that, the Hyundais as well, and what has now become obviously the Genesis as well. Now, I would say you're the second generation of that. Yeah. So that where Peter and then Luke came in and he brought you guys obviously on board and everything. What was the baseline that Peter was capable of being successful, apart from him obviously being a great designer? But what's the mindset behind the people in Korea / the culture that they respect design to such a degree? Because we see that with not just you guys, but also with LG. We see that with Samsung. Yeah. That there is this respect for design, and I really say design and not styling, to make better products in the end. That, to be fair, we're not necessarily just seeing yet out of China. In that regard, we have seen it out of Japan. It was one of their big pushes before that as well. Where does this come from? Is this just because of this context of, okay, we want to be global and we need to adapt and we need to understand it? Or what's your interpretation of that?
I think it's very important, as you said, there are two chapters in that for our company's experience. Peter, I mean, we had a chairman who realized that to be truly global, to be truly successful, we need to have design at that quality. And Peter came here after. I used to bump into Peter very often in airports back and forth to Asia. He was always on the way to Seoul. I was always on the way to Shanghai or Beijing. But what he did there to prove that design was not styling, design was way, way more than making something that looks nice. Now, that didn't come to Hyundai until Luke was here in the same way. It was very much focused on Kia, but our current chairman, Oizon Chung, is incredibly innovation focused, incredibly focused on the planet, how we talk about the progress for humanity is the main thing. It's not we're going to do cars. We're going to help humanity progress somehow in whatever way that is. How do we do that? And the first chapter with Peter really showed that Kia can do it, can become a global player with global design, where proportion, where technical solutions are integrated into a good-looking, simplified product. Before then, probably we were quite complicated. But Hyundai then, I think, tried to do the family look. But we have such a great portfolio and a conservative, take-no-risks family look. And it was just like making white goods. It was like buying a washing machine, as an English journalist told me when we presented Ioniq 6. He said, it used to be you go buy a Hyundai like you buy a washing machine. It doesn't really matter what it looks like. It's got to have a couple of good functions and run well, and then it stops working, you buy another one. It's okay. But now there's a level of emotional attraction behind it, and that comes through good design. It comes through good technology, comes through good marketing, comes through good sales. And you you combine lots of factors into, we combine loads of factors, as every designer who's listening knows, all those complicated inputs. But the drive from our chairman, really, to raise the level. And when we make design presentations in that room down there that I'm looking into, he will always choose the most innovative solution, the most unexpected. Because we have the Hyundai look, where we deliberately don't make them all look the same. We deliberately stretch the bandwidth, where we focus hugely on the customer. They are customer-centric design. How do we get the product closer to the customer? Because each customer has a different lifestyle, has a different way of living, a different usage need for the vehicle. And so they, like a chessboard, and chess players in Western chess, they each have a different role to play, the players, different move to make. And we basically do that for our cars at the highest level of innovation. And that starts with usability, understanding the customer, understanding their lifestyle, if they're working with the car, how they work. We understand our own heritage, how that can impact, and understand the latest correct technologies for 5 years' time that we need to bake in. And so we are part of a wave of sort of Korean acceptability. We're not big enough. Like, you know, if you're in the UK and you support Man United, everybody else hates you. but we you know, because that's what you do. You just hate Man United, no matter who you support.
I can agree on that one.
You see, there we go.
As you all know, I'm a big Bayern fan. So
and in Germany, everybody hates Bayern. That's it. And so, but we globally, Korea's not big enough for everybody to hate you. It's kind of, oh, yeah. I mean, we're a big player now. I think the latest volumes are like we're number three in the world as a group, which is
like 5.5 million or something like that.
Yeah, which is not our plan. Our plan is awesome cars for people who love them. And by the way, it could be a hydrogen fuel cell car. It could be a plug-in hybrid. Could be a hybrid. Could be diesel. Could be full electric. We have a bandwidth in a portfolio. And what does that give us as designers? The massive challenge of understanding consumer lifestyle, understanding how people are using products. And it's definitely not looking, my marketing colleagues, apologies now, looking at a marketing survey, looking at a clinic result. That's one part of the story, but that's today's answer. We're looking for signals for tomorrow's answer, and the customers haven't even thought of the question yet.
Yeah. I use you guys, interestingly, quite regularly as an example of this kind of market-relevant product. Because, you know, a lot of companies, what you've mentioned earlier, they still think in global products and you do one for all, and that's just not working anymore. But you guys have made that adjustment that you have stuff for the, let's say, the Asian market, you have stuff for Europe, you have stuff for America, and it just goes into that context as well. Now, for you as a design boss, let me just, this is where it's
Oh, design now. Boss. I'm a design
boss. Check it out. Happy day.
I feel important.
But if you start a briefing to your team and all these kind of things and say, okay, this car is now for Europe, are you saying we're doing something for Europe and it carries the Hyundai badge and it has to carry certain Hyundai values? Or do you also say, like, look, we have a certain heritage that we want to respect because Hyundai has gone a long way and everything that it goes into, and we want to bring those into there and show them that there's somewhat of Korean culture, Korean design in there. And the reason why I'm asking that is, of course, nowadays we have all these K-pop topics, you know, like Korean culture really made it into the Western world.
Yeah.
So how do you find a balance of that? Or do you just say, like, no, we just look into the market, we look into the customer groups, and we make the right thing for the customer group. And then how we do it is the way we do it as a Korean-led company.
There are layers to it. We don't want people to look at it and think that looks Korean, or that looks Chinese, or that looks German. We want to people look at it and think, wow, that's a Hyundai. And we look at the different regions. Sometimes we have products which are only regional products, cars which are only in India, only in Europe, only in Korea, for example. But we also have the global products that we tune a little bit according to the market requests in smaller details. I think there are four building blocks to that. Firstly, what's the lifestyle of the consumer? What is the consumer lifestyle? How do we want to complement their life with a product? What do they need? The second one, if they're working with the vehicle, what's their site of their work? How do we help them when they're using our vehicle as part of their work? The third one is, do we have some of our own heritage, which goes into that, but doesn't look Korean? We're not trying to make Korean-looking cars, but is there some heritage where if you dig a bit deep, you think, oh, now I realize. And finally, what kind of tech goes into it? And we are in a super high-tech market here. the speed of delivery, the convenience of stuff, the 5G in the metro, wherever you go, and you look on your Naver app and you see that the train going from your stop is in 37 seconds. And when you get to the next exchange, you have to go to this door and it'll get you fastest to where you're walking to afterwards. It's so convenient. And I think that tech approach of understanding consumer needs and time saving and is so powerful that it helps all of our products, all of our vehicles. But what's interesting, as a designer, you have to be really prepared to have a fight. Really prepared. Do you truly believe the signals that you're reading? We look at the signals, build a briefing. And I remember, he may never listen to this, but Albert Biermann, during our Ionic 6 selection presentation, where he came up to me, he said, "No," and his team were livid with design because we grew the wheelbase. We had the wheelbase, which is 50 millimeters longer than what was written on their bit of paper. And the team was saying, "You got this wrong in the design and you should have done this and this." I said, "Wait a second. You wrote that down on that bit of paper before realizing what it means to the product. You just wrote stuff down. Now, I understand why. Of course, for me, that is a start point, not an end point." Mm-hmm. And that is a time where we need to grapple with it. And sometimes things change. We have to be flexible. And so the chairman comes in and says, "I want to do this or that." There's different inputs. And I think we need to make sure in any organization, we don't fix the wrong things too fast. We allow ourselves to challenge. We allow ourselves, as signing up and I always discuss, how much trouble can we get into? Because if we're not getting in any trouble in the organization, we won't be in the organization for long because we're not disturbing enough. If we get in too much trouble, we won't be in the organization for longer either. So we have to find the sweet spot of getting into enough trouble. And I think culturally, in various countries, there's a different way of looking at that. In China, there's a very hierarchical, you're going to do this and that's it, no discussion.
Yeah.
But in startups, that really helps having a vision, say, this is what we're going to do. But you need that really strong direction with the what ifs around it. If you can get those two working in harmony, because you get fast decisions, you go forwards very fast. And that's something that I think we are very fortunate at the moment, Hyundai, because we make really important decisions quickly, but we do have the space for the discussion, the space for design to get into trouble. And that's, I think, something where Peter has undoubtedly made such a great advance for the whole company understanding. And Luke and Sangyup in particular have brought that into the Hyundai side and the Genesis side, where we have, a lot of drive to do things different and boldly, and not just because it's written on the bit of paper, give ourselves the chance to see other things too in the process.
Yeah. Has this also been a little bit of a pressure point for you guys internally nowadays to say, like, we're so progressive, we're like, look at what we're doing, it's very different, and arguably also it's successful. Yeah. I mean, look at the 5, for example, where you say, like, you know, the chairman now expects more of being questioned, of being challenged in that sense.
Because it's horrible. It's absolutely awful. Because you Ionic 5 wins with World Car of the Year, World EV of the Year, World Design of the Year. The following year, Ionic 6, World Car of the Year, World EV of the Year, World Car Design of the Year. Guess what they're thinking? Oh, it's easy. Go do it again. Ask Michael Jordan about doing a repeat three-peat. And that you realize there are so many good designers out there and amazing companies that I feel very honored to know we're part of this organization with amazing teams. But of course, it raises the expectation level. And what's not noticed is that the manufacturing team are also raising the level so much. The engineering team are raising the level so much. The infotainment team are raising the level so much. The brand marketing, everybody is raising the level. Because if we don't, I used to say, if you don't innovate, you die. Better self-disrupt before getting disrupted.
Yeah. You said something really interesting to me that I want to draw back to this a little bit. You said the tech influence, obviously, on design and everything as well. Now, obviously, we're very similar kind of age. Unfortunately, not. We look very similar.
I'm older.
That's unfortunately because I look old and you look very young. But if you look back into your, you know, the beginning of your career, the early stages of your career, and you look into new tech coming into cars and stuff like that, and now, you know, obviously the big boss is deciding everything what you want to do. Now the tech, of course, is adapted first and foremost by the younger generation. So probably by your younger, the entry level guys. How do you think your management style has changed to allow for this new tech to come in, to be explained to you, for you to make the most or the best possible decision to say, we go ahead with this, even though maybe it's very far away from how you use it every single day, or it's something that you don't really use every single day? Because if you're having people that are so involved in tech every single day, and I see this in China, I see this, like I said, in Japan as well, Korea, for you as a manager, when you're not in that exact generation, you don't watch the same things and so on and so on, you need to be educated and then make a good call. How do you make that happen? Because that's really difficult. And people coming out of an older generation, in my opinion, from what I'm observing, struggle a lot with that.
Let me wind back the clock to last week, where I was explaining to journalists that 60% probably of what I do is motivation. 60% is motivating teams to realize that I'm supporting them 100% to say what they think. Now, in a Korean culture where it is so hierarchical, some of the journalists last week said to me, what's it like working with the Koreans? I said, I don't know. I just work with people. Everybody is people. And how do we get the best out of that group intelligence? But one thing, me personally, I try to do, I work very hard at making sure everybody knows they can speak up, and that everybody knows that I really want to hear what they think and what they say. Because I just came out of a meeting with our digital team, and there were four young digital designers showing me different stuff to do with systems, process, AI, and so on. I said, this guy, you know how old I feel looking at this lot? But I'm sitting here using Midjourney all the time to experiment with stuff as well. And so we have to keep it fresh. We have to find the time to understand that, but we also have to get people to realize they can question me, they can ask questions, they can say what they think. And often one of the things I use mostly to give teams self-confidence, to give every individual self-confidence, is ask them to explain something via their personal experience. Because if somebody's talking from a point of view of personal experience, they cannot be wrong. They have the foundation. They know they're right because that's their story. And so it gives people great confidence to go into other things and to talk about other things and discuss other things. So I guess my own character of getting people comfortable, we had an interior review this morning, and I go in there into the presentation room, and I sit on the floor. I sit on a beanbag on the floor. Everybody else is sitting higher than me. In terms of being submissive, to allow people, give people the stage, get the teams using or feeling confident that, you know, they're in an important position. And so I try and create that at every opportunity. I just came back lunchtime today. I'm playing basketball with the guys. One of the guys, an intern, we play basketball lunchtimes, and they know in the studio. I know in the studio, I can't shout at anybody, but on the basketball court, I can shout at everybody. But they can barge me around. They can push me over. They can force me. They can defend. They can block. They can screen against. And it just is a way of connecting to people. And if you can connect to people, one of the most biggest challenges is learning everybody's name in the studio. Because it's not simple names like Martin or Simon. It's complicated names like Hyung Sun, you know, Piljun Ham, Jiyun, So Young. They're names that aren't on our vocabulary. But the most important thing to me is learning people's names. And remembering Saguk and Woo Soon and these guys, these team members, by being personable, by being connected, it's a way of building trust. Building trust. So when you make the difficult decision that you go in one direction, not the other, the team will support you. A bit like being a manager on a sideline. I love the basketball documentaries. So if you're watching, you know, The Last Dance, and you see how Michael Jordan developed in his career, he realized he couldn't do it all himself. And he needed the other team members. And that, for me, is just like us here. We need each other. We use from another basketball documentary where Doc Rivers, please watch it on Netflix. It's A Coach's Rulebook. And it's about Boston Celtics and Doc Rivers brings into the team an African philosophy called Ubuntu. The guys here are fed up with me going on about it because Ubuntu, putting it simply, means you being good at what you do makes me better.
Yeah.
Now, in design terms, we're often fighting our own, doing our own thing. I want to do my thing to win, do it by myself. You can't. You can't do it by yourself. You're stronger if you can use the group intelligence on things and get teams to work together. And I guess that's probably one thing I'm reasonably average at, is getting people working together and communicating with each other and telling me what they think. But still, because we have the trust, they trust when you make the difficult decision, say we're going to do this and make it clear. The teams are so grateful for a clear decision. Mm. And that's, I guess, part of what I love doing. And I love in this organization how there's that energy to, okay, do the different thing, to do the special thing, do the box, Santa Fe, just do the box. When we presented those models, I remember we had the company coming to me say, you can't present that model. Why not? Well, it's not on a bit of paper. That's not what we've described. It's too different. And I said, well, that's exactly why we present it. And in the presentation, within 5 minutes, the chairman's leaning against it, saying, I want to do this. And so yeah. I think what Hyundai is doing, and what I'm so impressed with so many teams here, our own design teams, but our engineering teams. We have a head of engineering who, hey, Juan, how he creates a positivity of trying to find a solution rather than saying that's not possible or it's impossible. And that it's so nice. I don't think I've ever worked in an organization where the relationship between engineering and design and the first line of the engineers trying to innovate, trying to find a new way cleverly is so impressive in this company. And that's what I love about the people here. And people say to me sometimes, oh, are there many Koreans in your team? In South Korea, in Namyang, which is like the middle of the countryside, there are only two Westerners. And that's very fortunate for me. I have an interpreter and a secretary who are brilliant. But I just see people. I just see people trying to do good stuff.
Do you think that, and I know this is a little bit of a provocative question, so I do apologize for that upfront, but do you think what you have just explained could also happen in China? Because obviously in China, you have this very, you mentioned it earlier, the hierarchy, the top down, you know, very much also in terms of education, everything that comes along with that. And I personally think, you know, the biggest complaint that comes out of China, where cars look very similar, they, you know, have a very different kind, a very similar kind of direction, every single one to each other, with the only differentiation at the moment is the kind of operating system on the interior. Do you think what you have just mentioned, this kind of push for something, do something, dare something, be courageous in that sense, will eventually come to China as well? And what needs to be done based on your experience for them to have that kind of push, what you guys have shown over the past, I would say now, like obviously 10 years or so?
Without a doubt. Absolutely. I think China is very clearly developing at incredible speed. It's very clearly a protected market, and that is helping them develop in a certain direction. And that direction is run by one company called the Communist Party, and it's going in one direction. And they are looking for sure now at how do we become globally more powerful. And of course, that's what every company wants, to be more successful globally, it seems. But that's where communism has this amazing capitalistic approach. And so, yeah, I'm sure it's happening. But what China do, there's an old proverb in China, is that you sit by the river and wait for the corpses of your enemy to float by. You don't have to face it head on. Somebody should wait. Play the waiting game. They have time because they haven't only got 5 years. You know, most governments have 5 years, got to get it done.
Yeah.
But they have a five-year plan. It goes straight forward. And we don't like the system. You're not free. But if you don't try and buck the system and you're in charge, you're amazingly free when you're there. It's gone extremely nationalistic to the point of being, you know, for me, quite scary. It's quite scarily nationalistic, and we don't need you, and this truthful in some places. But I've so grown beyond borders through the amount of, I travel to the different countries we've all worked in. It seems so archaic doing a passport control. It's like, it's weird. I was so like, so you're just cutting off. And then Brexit, the most, for me personally, the most ridiculous thing. You know, if I fly into Frankfurt Airport with my Korean colleagues, the Korean colleagues can all go through the automated passport scan.
I know.
But the British can't. I have to queue with like a million other people for ages. It's like, oh. And it's just this separation policy, which is, I understand to some extent, but I also find it's just dangerous as well. So that's something where, coming back to your original question about, are China going to be looking and doing this? Absolutely. They're looking to sort of take over the world, the Belt and Road policy, be more successful, and they'll only get to a certain level within their borders. So how do we grow beyond that? And that's sort of almost any capitalist company looks at it that way. I think we get too capitalist and we try and grow too much, which is dangerous. Just do better stuff.
Yeah, this is the old Steve Jobs theme, isn't it? He said, like, we have to do great products and then they will sell automatically.
There we go. You
know? And
don't put it's a one number of the reasons. It.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also one of these reasons. It's like, you know, deal with a great product. Who do you want to sell it to? Why you want to sell it? You know, the questions of, does this make the life better?
Yes.
In that context.
And progress for humanity. Progress. That's, you know, and that's why we look at hydrogen fuel cells. We look at flying vehicles. We look at heavily at sustainability and circularity. It's all about, how do we make life better for people? And for Hyundai, my brand, as it were, how do we do the most progressive solution to help people in 5 years' time? What's the most progressive exterior design, the most progressive lighting, the most progressive interior design, the most progressive infotainment with our colleagues there and who are doing amazing stuff? Well, how do we do the most progressive Hyundai? That's where we need to be. Where people look and think, oh, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. To make that, you have a various amount of studios. Yeah. And you have Europe, you have India. India is very much a market-specific studio. I want to talk about that a little bit later because I find that very interesting. But you also have America. What strategy? And obviously then the Namyang studio, which is the biggest. And I think
and
you
Japan.
Have Japan as well.
And China.
Yeah, Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yokohama.
So you're
if I don't mention it, these guys will be pissed with offering me. So
I know. I'm sorry. I knew you had it. I knew you had it. So like, you know, I'm sorry that it wasn't in that context. But what I want to say with that is, what is your strategy in terms of the creativity in those studios? And what my question for that is, are you actively trying to kind of get Europeans also to Korea and, you know, Japanese to America and those kind of things? Or do you run this? I think what Toyota does this really well. They say, no, our studios are local. We want to have the local people there to give us their ideas. And in Japan, we have mainly Japanese people. In Europe, we have mainly the Europeans and so on and so on. What's your attitude towards that? Because you've mentioned just now the studio in Korea or Namyang has, I think, you know, two Westerners on the higher levels in that sense. Is that something that you want to change, something that's important as well for the local people to have different kind of cultures coming in as well? Or what's the attitude that you have towards that as well? Because there's no right or wrong here. It's more just like, you know, how do you get that kind of push that you're looking for?
Doing it. I mean, we have 9 studios around the world, 2 in India, 2 in China, and then 2 in South Korea, then 1 in Japan, 1 in Germany, 1 in North America. Hopefully that adds up to 9. Yeah, otherwise I'd miss somebody, I'm in trouble. But our job is, we're looking for the best talent around the world, everywhere. But we can't bring them all to Korea. We simply just simply from visas and working and everything and cost. If we have a studio in those influential places, then we get those skills. So why focus those skills only on that market? So there's 2 things. They have to work on the vehicles specifically for their market and do proposals, but we make sure they also have the opportunity to work on global projects too, or regional projects, which aren't for their region, because we get fresh perspectives. So it's a balancing act. And, you know, I think if you ask Eduardo, the fun they're having with both doing local projects and global projects, and they've been doing some China projects, US projects, European projects. You ask Haksu Ha out in Irvine, and they're working some stuff for India at the moment, as well as for their own market, as well as global projects. The key thing in it all, and this sounds incredibly boring, is that just upstairs above me, we have the team called the Design Project Management Team, DPM team. And without those teams, we would be absolutely lost. And we would probably be doing nearly everything in Namyang. We would not know, the left hand wouldn't know what the right hand's doing. With our team upstairs, Sun Yol is our leader of that team, compliments to him and his guys, because they manage the resources across like it's one big resource. And projects are coming up. We look at who's busy, who's not busy, who would have a good input on this, who seems about right. And then we, not quite, but almost put it out to tender in the groups. Look, oh, we think you guys will work on this. And if another team says, oh, we want to have a go as well, fine. But it's all managed in one process. I never look at my diary, or very rarely do I look when do I need to see a project, when I put a design review, because I know these guys are planning it all. And it sounds really mundane, but if you don't manage well and manage your resource, you just don't know. And so we have this fantastic cycle of review of management meetings to make sure we're utilizing all the brain power and not overloading one part of the system. I remember I had a night out. I was in Seoul and it was probably 11 o'clock at night. I had a few beers and I got the wonderfully convenient driver service to drive me home in my car. And Eduardo called me and he said, Simon, we got too many projects. Now, this is a satellite studio. Normally, you're struggling to get projects. And Eduardo calls me and says, Simon, we've got too many projects. I need your help. I said, Eduardo, write me a list. Just write the list of everything you're working on, and I'll look at it tomorrow morning. By the time you come in the next morning, we will have taken something off that list for you. Because we have a culture of allowing people to speak up and allowing people to say, look, got a problem here or not. I need a project. And so last weekend, I was in Irvine in the studio. Man, I've never seen them with so many projects as at the moment. But that's the same across our whole organization. Everybody, if I go to Yokohama to the team up there, the projects they're working, India Choi in Delhi, she's running the team and they're a new team in Delhi. But we know they don't have the skills yet for doing exteriors, for example. They're mainly a research and interior team, but they did the vision film briefings for our projects there. So when we come to a presentation, and I'm not presenting it, we've got Kaushal, who's come over especially. He presents that. And we talk through, this is what we want to do with this project. This is what it looks like. This is why. And so even if we're not doing the project, they're helping really disseminate the briefing, the work direction, the ideas to the teams in the rest of the organization. And so recently our Yokohama Japanese team were over in Delhi with those guys working project together. And so we can't have everybody in one place. We can't get everybody mixed up all the time. But having global exchanges where we move people around to get the experience, to build trust, to grow our international perspectives is something that we have our own internal HR team in design who are helping us do that. And so it's a balancing act to make sure we have the skills in the right places, but we rotate them. Not everybody all the time, but there's a level to which we can do that.
Yeah. I want to jump quickly onto India.
Yes. As
kind of the bigger
jumping on India,
you know, endpoint.
Jumping
on India. The reason why I want to do that is I had a conversation with Pratap. Obviously, yep. Pratap Bose, we know him very, very well, both of us.
Yeah.
And in an episode for exactly this series, we were talking about, I asked him, like, you know, what makes India special? And he said to me, well, you have to really understand the market because there is this similar kind of technology that came in where everybody has a system in place of like a phone and everybody's digitally and, you know, adapt to that sense as well. And they want their vehicles to be in that context as well. However, of course, the financial situation is not on as it is in the first world, for example. So there's a balance that you have to find. And I asked him, like, who are the companies from the outside in that really managed to do that? And he said, well, it's Hyundai that really came in and understood what we need to do for India, you know, make an impact, make products for that as well. How difficult was that?
Nice.
Yeah, so, like, you know, kudos to him. So, but how difficult was that for you guys? You say, like, obviously, like, you know, you try to look into the market, try to understand the people there as well and everything, but going into something like that where others have failed quite drastically, what just made it from a design's perspective a successful topic? And now you've released another one just very recently, of course, and you continue to be successful over there. So what's that kind of understanding that design needed to create to be successful for that?
I think it's not only design. You have to compliment the bigger company, the other decision makers in the organization who've made some pretty damn good decisions. And that is all about not trying to overly centralize. So finding a way somehow of being a very powerful center, but also having the local teams who are able to communicate, to share, to understand locally what's happening and to be able to react on that. I think it's about not building the arrogance of, oh, we know how to do this and we're going to show you now. There is a lot of that in other companies. You know, some other companies, you see the senior managers walk into a meeting from, it's just embarrassing. It's just don't be like that. You know, live and learn. I think our guys are learning a lot. And really, you know, we have a studio in Hyderabad, which does a lot of our digital work, actually. You know, India is so techie and they're into digital. And so we have a huge digital studio. What does that mean? Every part of our group, all our design studios, send stuff to Hyderabad. Guys, help us. Can you do this? And the guys are regularly here. We're looking at data control checking models regularly. I think it's about a mental openness. Mm-hmm. Coming back to that quote I used earlier, just because people think different doesn't mean they're wrong. But also there's a huge dollop of luck involved in that, or you get lucky, maybe right time, right company, right band. I love going to India to our launches there. I had to not go to one recently, and Choi presented for me. I really wanted to because we're a celebrated brand in China. Maybe we learned with our China experience, which is a very difficult, very challenging for us in China. Maybe something there has helped us in India. I think India is. I hope I don't get a nasty message from Pratap on this, but it's a bit like China was. You know, it's come through similar learnings. They've jumped on digital very quickly, the techie side. And hey, that's what Korea is all about, jumping on tech and digital. So that naturally helps us in the Indian market.
Yeah, and it's funny. Pratap will not be angry with you because it's exactly what we discussed, this kind of similarity between, you know, India and China, but obviously learnings that you can take from it. And I think it's also, let's say, the wish for something cool. If you look into India, you know, they have access to Instagram, you know, all these kind of outlets on social media that they see something globally and they want to do it. We see this now more and more interestingly in Japan as well. Korea is obviously a big one with that as well. The whole world becomes much more globalized. And then these outlets like Instagram, I think is still the biggest one.
Well, India is huge on Instagram. I mean, when I was there for an event we were presenting and we had two PR events, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. I didn't realize. I thought the morning one was the one. That was the automotive press. And it was a wonderful group of people who had these wonderful historic stories about, oh man, I wish we could smell the petrol still and the brakes and things. And I said, guys, things have moved on. Yeah. Then in the afternoon, we had the social media people and I'm meeting people and they say, oh, can I have your Instagram? It's swap me Instagram. This lady has 25 million followers. Okay. And I have 12, you know, it's like, but you meet, there's such a different perspective on a brand being cool and what you've got to do. And that, the afternoon group was the show me the screens, the tech, how to digital keys, how do I, you know, digital ecosystem. Blah. The morning group was sniff petrol. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with the website. I mean, old people talking. And I said, guys, it's over. Yeah, it's a shame we can't do this. Yeah, it's over. The time's moved on. And so, yeah, that balance between traditional media and modern social media is a bit like the difference in a way for me between petrol engines and EVs. Time moves on and there will be a time where there is no more petrol. Maybe 20 years away, maybe 100 years away, maybe 200 years away, whatever. There is a defined amount of that resource on the planet. And so I just think we should be trying different things as well. And I'm lucky enough to have my ridiculous, ridiculous Ioniq 5N that I can get into and cheer me up every morning on the way to work, realizing that a company like this can be so creative and create a car that wins World Performance Car of the Year. Not EV performance car, World Performance Car, above everything else. Our creative engineers are N Division, who are, quite frankly, completely start raving mad, come up with these ideas that I can only celebrate the creativity in that. And for Hyundai in India, we have we have so many cars we're working on, projects for the Indian region. But I think in India, there is a bit of luck. There's a bit of amazing decision making. There's making sure we have two design studios there. Oh, it's only two countries. We have two design studios, China and India, outside of Korea. And so in that respect, I think we're listening to the right level. We're being innovative. We're pushing hardware and software and the ecosystems of both. And it's a tribute to our great teams, not only design teams, again, coming back to the other teams in the organization who are delivering such awesome stuff.
Simon, we could continue for hours and hours and hours, but I have to go to an airport, and you deserve a little bit of sleep because you have literally just come back from...
Exactly, just got a plane from LA. But going back to LA next week, can't wait. Ireland 9 launch. So hopefully I didn't say anything I shouldn't have said. And so I think it was pretty good. Great to see you, Martin. I'll probably overlap
Thank
with
you.
Thank
you for doing it, Simon. I'll see you in London.
Looking forward to that.
That's the latest.
And, thanks for recording that and sharing it with Martin. Thanks for your support as well. And see you soon.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon.